From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
BP on the Capitol Hill hot seat. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Tony Hayward, the CEO of BP, apologized today to the Gulf Coast, all Americans, and angry members of Congress, some of whom called on him to resign. They asked if BP cut corners to save money. Were warnings of trouble ignored? But it turned out there were more questions than answers. Members of both parties gave Hayward a hard time, but one Texas Republican accused the Obama White House of a $20 billion shakedown. We'll hear more of today's hearing, how the claims process is shaping up. Is Washington too tough on BP or not tough enough? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the Gulf oil spill, California, and the electric car. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. The CEO of BP, who once minimized the Gulf oil spill, apologized for it today at a congressional hearing. But Tony Hayward gave so few answers to a host of tough questions that one Democrat called him irresponsible. We'll hear more today. On Reporter's Notebook, will the Gulf oil spill create new interest in electric cars? We'll hear what California is doing to spearhead a major change in transportation. First, this news update. Under heavy international pressure to overhaul the blockade of Gaza, Israel said today it has agreed to ease some restrictions, at least in principle. Edmund Sanders is in Jerusalem for the Los Angeles Times. Edmund, always good to have you on our program.
Hi.
Agreed in principle. What does that mean?
That's what people are, I guess, trying to figure out today. What they put out today was more of a press release, really, than a policy statement or a new policy. They just said, in principle, they want to liberalize and make adjustments to their policy, but they really gave no details on exactly how they're going to do that or when they're going to do it. A lot of people are interpreting that as a sign that they really haven't decided yet and that they're under such international pressure to announce something, especially this week, that they went ahead and decided to announce this, even though they haven't really figured out exactly yet what they're going to do.
This, of course, in the aftermath of the botched attack on the ship that was trying to break the blockade. What are the possibilities here? What might they do to make things easier for people in Gaza?
It runs the gamut, really. I mean, they have a right now a list of pre-approved items that are permitted into Gaza. They could expand that list, to some degree, which would be a very minor change, not be of a great assistance to people in Gaza. They could switch over. Tony Blair has suggested, rather than having a list of permitted items, that they have a smaller list of just items that are banned, so that basically everything can go in, all kinds of food, household supplies, any kind of materials can go in, except for those things that are on a list of banned items or restricted items, which would be things like guns and weapons and perhaps cement, which they have concerns about cement going in there and being used to build bunkers and by Hamas. Or they could just open it entirely, or they could close it entirely. These are all things that have been suggested. I mean, some of the more conservative people in the government want to just close the Gaza border completely and be done with it. So these are all the different options, and they haven't really figured out yet which one they're going to go for.
So there's a lot of disagreement then within the Netanyahu government.
It's hard to know. I mean, there's disagreement about that as well. Some people say they're very close to a consensus. They'll reach one. Maybe it'll happen next week. Others are saying, no, that, you know, the policy on Gaza, this has been Israeli policy for the past 3 years. And to make a significant change to it is going to be a very dramatic about face for them. They've said for years that they need these restrictions to protect themselves. So to give them up suddenly is going to be a big change. And there's going to be a political price to pay for that at home, too, because a lot of Israelis don't really support necessarily. It's mixed, but some Israelis don't support relaxing the restrictions, especially until Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, who's being held captive in Israel, is released. They want something in return for this.
Held captive in Gaza.
In Gaza, excuse me. Yes.
Sure. You mentioned the cement issue and the possibility that it could be used for bunkers. You were in Gaza last week, as I understand it. Don't they need an awful lot of reconstruction after what the Israelis did to them a few years ago?
Yeah, there's thousands and, you know, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of homes and buildings that are still in rubble. And, I mean, not just from this last offensive, but from over the years, still a lot of work to be done. So it's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done. And they have recently been allowing certain amounts of certain supplies of cement to go in with international groups, with UN groups, for specific projects for building a school or a hospital, as long as that group vouches for the fact that that cement will stay with them and be used for that project. And that is one of the things that they're talking, that they said today, that they'd like to expand that so that you could see some rebuilding taking place, because that is one of the biggest problems that they have down there, that and just very dramatic and high unemployment.
You said a moment ago that some Israelis just want to close the borders completely and be done with it. Is there really any chance of that?
No, that seems, especially in this, I don't think that's even on the table right now. But that was, a cabinet minister did suggest that. You will read about that in the paper sometimes. Just what they would like to do is just seal it off and say this is Egypt's problem. You know, and Egypt had raised concerns last week when they heard this being floated around, saying no, you know, you can't do that. But, you know, Gaza has borders with Egypt and with Israel. Both of them have imposed restrictions, and Israel, you know, what some in Israel would suggest is just close the border and make it Egypt's problem. But I don't think that's very likely.
When you were in Gaza, what sense did you get of the morale of the people there?
It's very low. I mean, it's a very poor place, and it's a place that is used to problems, but is used to a better life. So it's very difficult to adjust to the fact that, you know, your lifestyle has been declining for the past 3 years very dramatically. So there is a real sense of desperation and depression. At the same time, like any place under those circumstances, it's there's a normality to it, and, you know, people are at the beach. It's nice weather right now, so people are having picnics on the beach, and kids are going to school, and it's not a complete standstill. People have, you know, struggled to make whatever lives they can, but you see a lot of unemployed men just hanging around on the streets with no jobs, and that's causing a lot of problems.
Okay, once again, an agreement apparently to, in principle, relax the restrictions on Gaza. We'll see what the policy looks like when it's announced. Edmund Sanders, a bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times in Jerusalem. Many thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, BP on the Capitol Hill hot seat. To the point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point.
The explosion and fire aboard the Deepwater Horizon and the resulting oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico never should have happened. And I'm deeply sorry that it did.
Again, that was expected by a lot of people, hoped for by a lot of people, but it didn't get Tony Haywood, the CEO of BP, off the hook with members of Congress. They accused BP today of having the worst safety record in the oil business, ignoring warnings of trouble, and cutting corners to save money. Here's an exchange with Democrat Henry Waxman of California.
Don't you feel any sense of responsibility for these decisions?
I feel a great sense of responsibility for the accident. We need to allow...
How about for the decisions that made the accident more likely?
We need to determine what were the critical decisions, and...
Did you get my letter, and did you review it?
I've read your letter, Chairman,
and
I've
reviewed it. And you realize in the letter we asked you to be prepared to discuss these issues?
As I've said, I've seen the documents following your letter, and... I can't pass judgment on those decisions.
Even though you've worked 28 years in the oil industry, you're the BP CEO, and you said safety is the biggest issue, and you have people under you making these kinds of decisions, and now you're reviewing them. Do you disagree with the conclusion that this was riskier to use this particular well lining?
I'm not prepared to draw conclusions about this accident until such time as the investigation has concluded.
Well, this is an investigation.
Hayward declined to answer a lot of questions, saying that he was not on the Deepwater Horizon, had not completely investigated decisions, as you just heard, that were made by people who were there. Waxman said he was refusing to take responsibility. Jonathan Tylove is at the hearing for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. And, Jonathan, good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Good to be here.
This is pretty rough stuff.
Yeah, though this is probably the 40th hearing on BP that Congress has held in the last several weeks, and Lamar McKay, the CEO and president of BP America, has taken the brunt of this for so long that, you know, at least Tony Hayward was new to this particular part of the process and, I don't know, showed some composure, and I think he was fully expecting what he got and is just figuring out a way to kind of be non-responsive without looking contemptuous of them.
Well, we heard Waxman just now refer to the well lining. Members of this committee have accumulated an enormous amount of material, or the staff has, and they've briefed themselves to some extent at least on what's going on, or what happened, I should say, and how the process all works. Was there anything new today, substantial news? I realize the hearings are still going on, so something more could happen this afternoon. But was there anything new at the in the first part of the hearings?
No, I don't think there was. So in that sense, it's a little bit anticlimactic. But I'm not sure you could have expected anything particularly new. The committee has reviewed, it says, 30,000 pages of BP documents and gone through their emails and has accumulated a lot of evidence of what they say is cost-cutting for purposes of maximizing their profit. And what's kind of interesting is this is the committee, the Investigations Committee of Energy, that does the most, you know, deep digging, and the Republicans and the Democrats have pretty much agreed on what they found. So they're finding BP very culpable in this. Where it gets political and where it breaks down is, I think, the Republicans would like to place more responsibility on federal regulators, and also there was it began with Joe Barton of Texas, the ranking Republican, saying he thought that the $20 billion that the president wrested from BP for an escrow account was amounted to a shakedown. So there's a little bit of tension there. But in terms of what they found about BP, I think there's general agreement, and I think that the point that Tony Hayward's making is that he's not going to confirm something that he thinks is still being investigated.
When we heard at the end of that soundbite we heard with Waxman Hayward, Waxman made a reference to this being an investigation, and there's talk of other investigations. One of them is a criminal investigation, is it not, being conducted by the Department of Justice?
It is, and I think that's where a lot of members of this committee think it's going, and in fact, Barton made that point. He's not saying that BP is not responsible for all of this. It may not even be criminally responsible. He just thinks that there's a problem pursuing a criminal prosecution, even as you're calling a company in and saying, well, if you give us some money, that might help. So I think there is a real prospect of a criminal prosecution, and certainly they're on the hook for, you know, an enormous amount of money here, and they are accepting that responsibility. And I think that the kinds of things this subcommittee has uncovered would likely be the basis for that kind of criminal prosecution. I think with Hayward, they're trying to say, what did you know and when did you know it? And he's saying, all I knew about this well was the one time in April when they told me they had this big find in the Macondo well. So he's saying he's the CEO. There's hundreds of wells being driven around the world. He's not intimately involved or even directly involved in the decision-making about how those wells are drilled. And at one point, Congressman Burgess, the ranking Republican on the subcommittee, said, well, that's what I'm worried about, that you don't know what's going on at these hundreds of wells being drilled around the world right now.
Did he respond to that, particularly when Burgess, I believe it was, asked him to be specific about wells that are being drilled now and operated in the Gulf?
No. I mean, his line was, I wasn't, you know, on any number of questions, was I was not involved in that decision, so it's impossible for me to answer that question. And, you know, Waxman was frustrated, Stupak was frustrated, they kind of sputtered a little bit, and then when you're stonewalling, he says, no, I'm simply not prepared to cast a judgment on something that I don't know the answer to and that is still the subject of an investigation. And I think, you know, his attitude is, you've got all my emails and all my documents, I wouldn't call that stonewalling.
Stupak, of course, the chair of the subcommittee, said at one point that BP really blew it, and as did other members of the committee, talked about the safety record that BP had over the years. It did sound as if Hayward was indicating that he was trying to, I think he said at one point, change the culture of BP. Do they go into that in any depth?
Yeah, I think it's clear that BP had the worst safety record for some time of all the major oil companies,
And, you know, Stupak said when he heard about this, the first thing he thought of when he heard about the blowout of the Deepwater Horizon was it's probably BP, just because he was used to dealing with them in investigations of accidents in Alaska and at the explosion at the Texas City refinery. But what Hayward's saying is I came in 2 years ago and my priority was safety, and he's saying that's why this hurts him so much. I think they're a little disbelieving, and they, you know, they're indicating that he's either turned a blind eye, or he's indicated through some kind of, you know, through his management that they were too cautious in their drilling procedures. But that's what's on the line here. I mean, he's saying that he was the new BP that was changing their reputation, and that all these things about their safety record may be true, but they predated him, except for this, obviously, which is the worst disaster in American history, so it's a little hard to say everything was great except for this one little thing.
We're going to hear in a moment more about the $20 billion trust fund. We're talking with Jonathan Tylove of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. There's also $100 million that's been pledged to oil workers for their losses because of the president's moratorium on oil drilling in the deep part of the Gulf. In your part of the world, in Louisiana, how are people reacting to that, and particularly to the $100 million? Do they think it's enough?
No, no. And it comes across, it came across as a bit of an afterthought. You know, the fear there, and, you know, Senator Landrieu said that the moratorium could be more economically devastating than the oil spill itself. I mean, you irreparably harm the fishing industry and then the oil industry. And in Louisiana, they're not seen as adversarial. They're seen as sort of symbiotic in their relationship. So it's hard to find people who are—they're mad at BP, but they're not mad at the oil industry or at drilling. And so there's a real concern that it's going to totally wreck the state's economy. And the $100 million—I mean, the figures coming out of members of Congress—is that that would last, you know, a couple of months or maybe only a couple of weeks to pay rig workers what they've been earning. And that, you know, the six-month moratorium won't just be 6 months. Rigs will leave the Gulf, go elsewhere, you know, go to Brazil, Venezuela, off the coast of Africa, and they won't come back. And I think also that the rig workers are only a fraction of the people who are harmed when the deep water drilling industry is harmed, because there's a lot of ancillary and support services and people more directly involved, but who are not strictly speaking rig workers. But that fund, as I understand it, is just for those who work on the rigs. And in talking yesterday, asking questions of Carol Browner, who was in the negotiations, you got the sense that this was in some ways a token effort, because the administration had said that BP ought to cover these people, the people affected by the moratorium, and I think they realized they didn't have any real legal standing to demand that.
Jonathan Tylove, once again, with the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Let's go back to the hearing, which is still going on as we speak. Thanks a lot for being on our program today.
Thank you very much.
Earlier, Jonathan made a reference to Joe Barton of Texas, who denounced the White House agreement for the $20 billion trust fund. Today, the Democrat Ed Markey from Massachusetts responded. Here first is Joe Barton.
I think it is a tragedy of the first proportion that a private corporation can be subjected to what I would characterize as a shakedown. In this case, a $20 billion shakedown.
No, this is not a shakedown of the company. This is the American government, President Obama, ensuring that this company is made accountable.
Barton's remark got an angry response from the White House, too. They called it shameful. Lauren Steffi is business columnist at the Houston Chronicle. And, Lauren, thanks a lot for being on our program today.
Thanks for having me.
What about the $20 billion and the $100 million afterthought, as it's regarded by many people in Louisiana? Do we have a sense yet of how this is going to work and how the claims process is going to be handled?
Well, I think that's one of the key issues here. You know, when it comes to the $20 billion fund, I'm not sure that this was a shakedown at all. I think it may have been a gift to BP. I mean, this basically offloads a lot of problems from BP and puts it on the administration. This fund is going to pay out based on how many fish weren't caught, how many hotel rooms weren't actually booked that would have been booked. Those are really tough things to get to the bottom of, and decisions are going to have to be made. And in some cases, the people who are filing those claims are not going to be happy with the outcome. And so when the fishermen get angry, when the hotel owners get angry. Now they're going to be mad at the government. They're not going to be mad at BP because BP's not the one making those decisions. So I think this is this has been a wonderful thing for BP, and in fact, their stock actually kind of has gone up a little bit as this came out, because it appears that it in many ways walls off the liability, and certainly it walls off some of the public outrage. As for the worker fund, I mean, I agree. It's not going to be nearly enough. If the six-month ban stays in place, it won't come close to paying the losses. But I think it's highly unlikely that ban will actually last 6 months. I think there's too much opposition to it.
So deep-sea drilling then will continue sooner than that, you're suggesting, and regardless of the risks.
Well, they're going to have to find a way to address the risk issue, especially with these spill response plans that we now know were basically just fiction. They're going to have to come up with a way to address that issue, yet still allow some of this work to go forward. From an oil price standpoint as well as an employment standpoint, the drilling ban could be truly devastating. So I think they'll try to find some sort of compromise, and I think part of the way they'll do that is they'll start looking at this as a company-specific problem, as a BP problem, as opposed to an industry problem, which is kind of the way you saw the discussion going at the hearing earlier in the week with the other oil company executives that all basically said, we wouldn't have done it this way.
Trying to separate themselves from BP as best they can.
Exactly, and that's very unusual in the oil business. Normally, the way this industry responds to crisis is everybody closes ranks. Everybody's on the same page. Everybody works together at some point, and so nobody wants to criticize another member of the industry.
Back to what you referred to as a possible gift to BP, even though it'll cost them $20 billion and perhaps more than that, what you're referring to is this independent claims process, it's called, that's going to be directed by Ken Feinberg, the man who dealt with the compensation to victims of September 11th. You say people will see this as a government operation.
I think they will, and it's going to be an incredibly bureaucratic process no matter who administers it, but now that it's under the control of the government, that means everything that goes wrong with it is the government's problem, and BP gets to dump the money in and then basically wash their hands of all those issues, and it's going to be up to the Obama administration to sort this out, and if anything goes wrong, it's going to be their problem and not BP's.
Is $20 billion going to be enough?
Probably not. I mean, I think it's a very open-ended liability at this point. And, of course, the government can go back and get BP to pay more money, but that's only part of the problem. The reason the government did this is they're very worried that BP may be forced into bankruptcy or get taken over in some way, something like that, and then who would pay the claims, and would it be harder to get those claims paid? And so this is seen as sort of an insurance fund. This way, they are guaranteed that money's put in up front. The problem is now it's their business to distribute it, and so they inherit all the fallout from that.
Lauren Steffi, again, a business columnist at the Houston Chronicle. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back then to continue this conversation with Jeffrey Fisher at Stanford Law School, who argued the Exxon Valdez case on behalf of commercial fishermen and other Alaskan businesses as well. We'll also talk with others about whether the government's doing enough or too much with regard to BP. On Reporter's Notebook, California prepares the way for the electric car. And tell us what you think on the To The Point Facebook page. Back in a moment with To The Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Well, I mean, only back with To The Point. Once again, Tony Hayward got some tough questioning today from members of both parties on Capitol Hill. As far as we can tell so far, nothing of new substance has emerged from the hearing, but a lot of Congress members are very angry at BP. Lauren Steffi, the business columnist at the Houston Chronicle, has just said that the $20 billion fund that BP has agreed to put up may be a kind of a gift to the company because it'll wall it off from public outrage. Jeffrey Fisher is a professor at Stanford Law now. He argued the Exxon Valdez case before the Supreme Court on behalf of commercial fishermen and other businesses in Alaska. And Professor Fisher, good to have you on our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Based on your experience in Alaska, or with the Alaska case, what do you think about this $20 billion fund, and does this, or will it make it easier for BP?
Well, I think that BP is doing, in a sense, by paying the claims, doing what it just simply has to do under law. It's incontrovertible, so there's a mixture of legal and public relations issues at stake here, obviously. And so I think, as your previous guest said, what the administration is at least demanding that BP do is step up with money to make sure that no matter what else happens to the company, at least these bedrock claims of people that incontrovertibly are deserving of money get paid as quickly and efficiently as possible.
Is there a likelihood that BP might go under?
I have no idea on that score. I'll leave that to the people that study those kinds of issues more closely than I do.
What about the presence of Ken Feinberg as the administrator of this fund? What's his reputation based on the 9/11 situation?
Mr. Feinberg has a wonderful reputation as a fair administrator of these horrible mass tort situations. He has experience from the 9/11 situation and a couple of other asbestos cases and a couple of other areas where he has administered large funds with thousands, tens of thousands of injured parties and distributed the money efficiently and fairly, I think, as judged by people on all sides of the issues.
Is it inevitable, though, as Lauren Steffi suggested, that a lot of claimants are not going to be happy?
I think that is inevitable. I can tell you from my own experience in the Exxon Valdez case that certainly is the case. There's one category of harm, things like money that fishermen didn't make and the like that are pretty obvious and that Exxon paid and that I imagine BP will pay. But when you get a disaster of this magnitude, there's harm that is more intangible and difficult to prove, but that is nonetheless real, and that what we found in the Exxon case, at least, was the local communities and local individuals felt harm and pain far beyond the money that they ultimately got put back into their pocketbooks.
So a lot depends then on Ken Feinberg, and BP won't have to worry about that.
I'm not sure that's the case. Certainly a lot depends on the first instance on Mr. Feinberg's administration of the fund, but I imagine that there will be further litigation with respect to whatever money isn't paid out and whatever claims aren't able to be administered in the fund, so that this isn't BP being able to entirely wash its hands of this. I would assume there'll be satellite litigation regardless.
Jeffrey Fisher at Stanford Law School. Back to Lauren Steffi, the business columnist at the Houston Chronicle. So this isn't the end of it, just this trust fund we're hearing, and other lawsuits may follow. What about BP's ability to pay it all?
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the big overriding questions here, and it's something that's clearly had a tremendous impact on their stock price. They've lost something close to, you know, $90 to $100 billion worth of market value since all this happened. And that gets to this issue of, you know, how long can they continue to pay this out? When a company's stock price drops that significantly, it leaves them vulnerable to a possible takeover. And I can almost bet that, you know, an Exxon or a Shell or even some big international companies like PetroChina are looking very closely at this and whether it makes sense to somehow make a bid for BP's assets and then wall off all of these liabilities through a bankruptcy of some sort that would be similar to some of the large, you know, asbestos cases or things like that. That's clearly being looked at on Wall Street. You know, Wall Street would love to see a deal like that because the fees are huge. But, you know, how that ultimately plays out, of course, is at this point it's still a little uncertain. I think companies are a little afraid to step into this. But that's an overriding concern is BP's long-term sustainability.
And here they are already, as we indicated earlier, separating themselves from BP, saying we wouldn't have done it that way. So are they sort of paving the way, do you think, for something like that?
Well, it could be. I mean, you know, one thing about BP is they have very, very attractive assets. Most of their holdings are in Alaska, the Gulf of Mexico, and the UK North Sea, which are very, very stable areas to drill for oil. It's not like, you know, West Africa or the Middle East or something like that. And so companies would really love to have those properties. What they're trying to figure out now is how they could get them at a cheap price without having to take on all these liabilities from the spill.
Let me turn to Tyson Slocum. He is a director of the Public Citizens Energy Program. Good to have you on our program.
Yeah, great to be here.
What do you think about the situation here? And is there a possibility of driving BP into such a situation that for one reason or another, it wouldn't be able to make the payments on these claims?
No, I mean, this is a corporation with $235 billion in assets, They've got extremely healthy cash flow from their global petroleum and natural gas operations. They will be able to handle claims associated with their responsibilities for creating the largest industrial and environmental disaster in American history. And unfortunately, this $20 billion fund is actually going to be woefully inadequate. We've got massive economic costs associated with folks thrown out of work. We have monumental cleanup costs that are going to be ongoing for years. And then how exactly do we put a price tag on the devastation to the marine and coastal ecosystems in the Gulf of Mexico and beyond? The company needs to pay all of these costs because taxpayers cannot afford yet another bailout of a hugely profitable corporation.
On the other hand, hugely profitable in the past, but it lost $90 to $100 billion in market value since the spill. That's not peanuts even for BP, is it? And what about the prospect of actually rendering it subject to a takeover and then a possible bankruptcy proceeding where its assets would be protected?
Well, again, the devaluation of its stock price does not inhibit its consistent cash flow, nor does it affect the value of its hard assets, which are substantial. This is one of the largest corporations in the world that has operations spanning the globe. And the thing that I am concerned about is BP taking steps to shield its lucrative international operations from the domestic liabilities associated with the Gulf disaster. We've got to make darn sure that this global company based in London, England, doesn't try to evade what it owes the American people and the residents of the Gulf. This is not this disaster. While regulators should have been on the job, the fact is that we deregulated the industry, putting more responsibility in the hands of the oil company. That clearly was wrong, but the fact is that the oil company had more responsibilities, and they failed, and they need to be held fully accountable.
Back to Jeffrey Fisher, professor at Stanford Law, involved in the Exxon Valdez case on behalf of businesses and commercial fishermen in Alaska. What about the legal situation here with a foreign company involved and many foreign companies involved, including and many countries, the Marshall Islands involved in part of all of this? Is there a way that that BP could shield itself from a liability legally?
I don't think there's a way that BP can do so after the fact. And the general rule under U.S. law is a foreign company doing business in the U.S. is subject to suit in the U.S. So I would expect that the issue you highlight would be decided just the way any other corporate liability case is typically decided, which is, was the parent company working closely involved enough with the on-the-ground operations to be held liable? The answer is usually yes. So I haven't seen anything to suggest that wouldn't be the case in BP's case yet.
Now, let me get a final voice into this conversation. Chris Horner is with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's also author of a book, A Power Grab, How Obama's Green Policies Will Steal Your Freedom and Bankrupt America. Chris Horner, good to see where you're coming from, and thanks a lot for being on our program.
Subtle, yes. Thank you.
What about the oil industry? And it came in for a lot of criticism today, of course, has now for many weeks because of what's happened in the Gulf. And what about BP? What's your take on it?
Well, my take has been that BP has been viewed within the petrochemical industry writ large as having soiled the nest for everybody for at least 7 years, but actually going back to at least the 1999 incident. Pipelines and plants and other assets blowing up and breaking and spilling. Well, the industry has a terrific safety record, and that's how they're viewed within the industry. Someone earlier, it might have been Lauren, commented that this is very odd that the industry is sort of throwing the bus this has been a long time coming. Friends of mine from the industry and from school have been saying this to me for quite some time. BP has been making life very difficult for them, and they're not in a position to find many friends, not that their industry could do them much good right now, but you will see more distancing. And frankly, it's because of what BP is bringing down on all of them now. If you look at the tens of thousands of wells drilled, and this one incident puts the rest of them, as well as the obvious economic and environmental costs, in risk, it goes back to other facilities, their Texas City plant blowing up. They have lost the plot. They outsourced an awful lot of their expertise. They furloughed this legacy Amoco engineering and expertise, and I have received more mail from what I'll call legacy Amoco employees saying you wouldn't believe how they've shot everything out to consultants and sent their expertise out the door, and it's been catching up with them for years.
Chris Horner with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Its name states its case. Back to Tyson Slocum with Public Citizen's Energy Program. Public Citizen, of course, begun by the consumer advocate Ralph Nader. Do you think that the industry in general has as good a record as Chris Horner does?
No. I mean, the fact is that what was clear at this week's hearing was that none of the oil companies had any sort of contingency plan to deal with a catastrophic blowout in ultra deep water wells in the Gulf of Mexico. And they didn't even have a accurate environmental impact statement to deal with resulting environmental problems of a blowout. So this is an industry that amazingly poured a lot of money and research into extracting and producing oil and gas, and apparently gave no thought whatsoever to deal with any problems. And this kind of groupthink is incredibly dangerous. And the fact is that none of these oil companies have a solution. And as long as we lack a solution to stop the flow of oil in the event of a catastrophic blowout in a mile of water, we cannot, as a society, proceed ahead with this activity until we can be assured that we're not putting the economy and our ecosystems at risk.
Back to Chris Horner. What about that and the fact that it's been revealed now that the disaster plans of all the companies that are drilling in the Gulf were almost identical to BP's, including references to experts and go-to people that were dead and animals such as walruses that don't live in the Gulf at all? What does that say about the industry's real attention to the issues of the Gulf itself?
Well, again, not to change the subject as we just did, the industry has a spectacular safety record. You don't have 36,000 wells drilled and this be aberrant because it is so isolated and not claimed to have a very strong safety record. Now, the contingency fees, we've seen plans, we've seen tremendous failure at government, of course. We've had pre-approved plans in place that weren't executed. We've had burns that didn't occur, booms that weren't delivered, and Jones Act waivers that weren't granted, permits to dredge and build buried shoals, etc., to stop to do the mitigation function. So while BP's, we understand industry's response to something, they were in essentially, as we say, space age environment here. Remember this, it was the occurrence we're talking about, and that seems to be very, it's typical of BP, not of offshore drilling. That much we know, and that's actually inarguable. The contingency plan, well, we've seen it fail at all levels, both governmental and industry, and it's rightly, just like the liability limits. What was it doing there at $75 million if you're going to have one at all? Rightly, ripe for review now. Sadly, this is what it took to prompt it.
But back to the question of the industry's safety record and the identity of the or the similarity of the various disaster plans, which obviously, as we are seeing now, aren't even remotely adequate to the task. Does that suggest that other companies ought to be made to adhere to higher standards?
There was an absence of regulation. There was a failure of regulation. This is regulatory capture, I think, governmental failure. You see here, they got away with things that, once again, in hindsight, are ludicrous. So, again, we see failure all over the place, and that's a shame. We should have found out through the traps we've been put in place, not through this tragedy, what was going on. So, remember, don't mix the contingency plans with their safety record. Contingency plans are not the safety record. The record is experience, and safety what has happened. And it's been, again, 36,000 wells and this. So the contingency plan is now a punchline. It's a sad one. But the safety record, this is a BP-typical incident, not a typical offshore drilling incident.
Chris Horner, again, with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Back to Tyson Slocum with Public Citizen. What do you say to that? Do you think that BP ought to be singled out, ought to be prevented from doing any more work in the Gulf?
Well, I think it's clear that BP has the worst track record of other oil companies. But it might be more attributed to luck that it wasn't another oil company that experienced this blowout, because you have to remember that while there's been tens of thousands of wells drilled in the Gulf of Mexico, there are far fewer ultra-deepwater wells. This is a relatively recent development. The first ultra-deepwater well was really drilled in 1997. So the industry does not have a long track record of relative success or failure, and the fact that it is clear that none of the oil companies institutionally spent any time planning for or thinking about or conceiving a blowout occurring at waters at this depth, that is an indictment against the entire industry. And to argue that this shows it's a failure of government, yes, clearly the Department of Interior has been exposed to be a poor regulator, but they were pressured from lobbying by the oil industry and lawmakers receiving campaign contributions from the oil industry to deregulate. We've been hearing rhetorically in this country for too long that government is in the way, that we need to let private industry take charge and let the free enterprise system work its magic. And the fact is that these large companies cannot be trusted to do the right thing when it comes to protecting American workers or protecting the environment. They will cut corners, whether we're talking about Wall Street, whether we're talking about multinational oil companies. The American people are sick and tired of paying for these corporations' misdeeds and mistakes. Okay. We have to regulate them.
Obviously, Chris Horner disagrees with a lot of what we have just said. We'll stipulate to that because we're running short of time. Jeffrey Fisher, back to you. You argued the Exxon Valdez case again before the U.S. Supreme Court. How long do you think it's going to take for the various claims to work themselves out? It's been a long time with Exxon Valdez.
Well, I can simply give you benchmarks from that case. That still happened in 1989, of course. Ultimately, the case went to trial for the claims that hadn't been paid in 1994 and ended up in a judgment being entered in 1996. And then appeals that Exxon took another 14 years to resolve. So it's only about a year ago that case finally got resolved all the way around. So it could be a long time, and I will tell you on top of that that case was handled under what all who really looked closely agreed was the masterful job of a trial judge in Alaska. So it's going to be a long time for the claims that can't get resolved quickly in the BP case, one would expect.
Lawrence Steffi, a business columnist with the Houston Chronicle, final word from you. You think that the president's moratorium is going to be over sooner rather than later because it is so expensive. Based on what we've heard this week particularly, but certainly over the last few weeks, what are the risks that something like this might happen again?
Well, I think that's one of the big unknowns. I mean, that's one of the things that I think that we have become much more aware of the risks of deep water drilling, although I think Chris also makes a valuable point that you know, this is clearly much more of a company problem than it is an industry problem. And I do believe that when the executives from the other oil companies went before Congress this week and basically said, we wouldn't have done it this way, that's a very telling thing. We need to make sure that they're certainly not doing it this way, but we need to find a way to have more oversight to ensure that the way they are doing it doesn't result in this kind of catastrophic result.
Okay, and we'll stipulate again that Tyson Slocum doesn't have that kind of faith in the industry in general. Thank you all very much for being on our program. Lawrence Steffi with the Houston Chronicle, Jeffrey Fisher with Stanford Law, Tyson Slocum with Public Citizens Energy Program, Chris Horner with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and our earlier guest, Jonathan Tylove with the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Good to have all of you with us today. President Obama calls the Gulf oil spill another wake-up call on the need for an economy that doesn't depend on oil. Now California has taken the lead in preparing the way for electric cars. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. More than 100 years ago, some of the earliest cars ran on electricity. Efforts to revive that mode of transportation fizzled a few years ago, but now California is making major investments to lead the way. Rebecca Smith is national energy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And Rebecca, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
California, of course, one of the major markets for automobiles in the world. What are they doing as a matter of public policy?
Well, as you mentioned a moment ago, Warren, California has been pushing low-emission cars for a number of years. They had a failed attempt to get the thing going in the late 1990s and basically pulled the plug on that around 2002, 2003. Now they're making another run at it, and the state is spending more than $200 million a year between now and 2015 trying to get public charging stations and all the other bells and whistles needed so that electric cars coming into the market will be a big success.
Why are those things needed in order to get people interested in electric cars?
Well, there's something you've probably heard of called range anxiety, which means that if you're driving a pure electric car and you only can go, let's say, 100 miles between charges, you might start getting anxious about mile 75. So they realize people are going to need chargers in their homes or garages, and they're going to need places where they can charge up when they're on the road.
Now, as I understand it, the best place for that is not necessarily a filling station.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, and there are many interesting aspects to this, is that the traditional network that we built up of thousands and thousands of gas stations probably is not going to meet the needs of this next round of electric cars. And one reason is they're probably going to take 2 to 4 hours to fully recharge. So these stations are going to go in places where people tend to linger. And some of the places being looked at right now would be, of course, places of employment, also sporting venues, churches, shopping malls, places like that.
So you would those businesses then want to advertise, we got a charging station, come on down?
Yeah, in fact, we're already seeing some of these stations being set up at shopping malls. Typically right now, they're allowing charging for free. I don't think that's probably going to be the case going forward, but no one really has figured out what the pricing strategy ought to be. There are some big box retailers that say, hey, I put one of these things in, I've got an affluent customer who's going to come and he's going to stay in my store for 2 hours or more. Wow, that's great. I mean, they're more than happy to give up a dollar's worth of electricity for that.
So is the state then paying, is this part of the $200 million a year to install these charging devices?
Yeah, it's really sort of a catch bag of incentives right now. There's quite a bit of federal money going into these, and the federal government is focusing on a handful of cities. Then also different states are throwing money in. California is hoping to get about half of all the electric cars produced. So I would say California is doing the most, and as you know, California prides itself as having a kind of car culture anyway, so it wants to be on the forefront of this.
What about car companies?
There are about 24 car companies that have said they're going to produce either pure electric cars, such as the Nissan Leaf, and the Tesla, of course, has a beautiful sports car, and then there are other companies that are going to produce what is called plug-in hybrids, where you'd be able to run on pure electricity for the first bunch of miles, maybe 10 to 100, depending upon the car. Then after that, you'd have a gasoline engine that would kick in. So there are different kinds of cars, but basically all the major automakers are going to have electric cars. And then we're seeing a bunch of new car companies that are unfamiliar to Americans. Many of these are Chinese firms also saying that they're going to be exporting cars here.
As you mentioned, wasn't that long ago that we had electric cars. GM in particular had one, but it only leased that car, and when it decided not to make them anymore, it just simply confiscated them. That made a lot of people angry.
Yeah. Well, in fact, there's one of the EV1s is at the Peterson Auto Museum right now, and it's one of the places where there was an old charger, and they're now thinking about maybe having a new one put in.
What's it going to cost to charge an electric car?
Very little. All the studies I've looked at show that it'll be far cheaper to use electricity than it would be to put gasoline or diesel in a car. And also, it reduces the pollution footprint because power plants are able to make electricity far more efficiently than the internal combustion engine makes energy.
And transportation is one of the major uses of oil. So if you could really get a lot of people driving electric cars, it might make a difference in getting off the oil economy, even though, as you indicate, somebody's got to generate the electricity.
Yeah, well, this is, and again, that's one of the interesting things, especially as a segue from your prior discussion. A lot of people are looking at this market now saying, wow, this Gulf oil spill is so catastrophic that they're wondering if this is going to have a psychological impact on people, sort of making them more receptive to electrification than they would have been absent the spill. And I think that's one of the things, there's going to be a lot of research done to see whether people feel a kind of revulsion at the oil economy and are now willing to embrace electricity.
Rebecca Smith, National Energy Reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Warren.
Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Cameron Ravzender and Christian Bordahl, our technical director, Mike Newport. You can email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point, and you can check us out on Facebook. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.